It's Monday, September 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, racial unrest continues in a southern U.S. city following a fatal police shooting.
The systematic use of indiscriminate weapons in densely populated area is a war crime.
Outrage and calls for action in Syria as fighting escalates. Also ahead, the first U.S. presidential debate is near. A new museum opens, and a country music star races up the charts. It's all on today's International Edition. Protests continue in Charlotte, North Carolina, following the fatal police shooting of a black man last week. Charlotte's police chief on Saturday released body and dashboard camera footage of the shooting after 5 days of demonstrations that have coalesced around demands that the public see the video. Chief Kerr Putney said that and other evidence the police were releasing would corroborate their account of how things unfolded, including that Keith Lamont Scott was holding a gun when he was shot.
We're releasing physical evidence. We're talking about DNA evidence. We're talking specific to a lot of the we all know there's a lot of stuff floating out there about what has happened, what was not on scene, was it a book, is there a gun. We're releasing evidence that we believe, based on our fact-finding mission, that it will give you indisputable evidence that the facts we started with are the facts that remain today, based on two independent investigations up until this point.
Community activists have been for days calling on Putney to release video of the shooting of 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott. The unrest, however, remains. VOA's Arash Arabasadi is in Charlotte with the mood on the Charlotte streets now.
Well, today's Sunday, and the way that the typical Sunday unfolds in the American South, it typically starts with church services and flows into football. So we today went to actually both. We went to outside of Bank of America Stadium where the Carolina Panthers are playing. There was maybe 50 people that we saw, and they were kind of in one area and surrounded by police that were initially during the morning hours. They said that they were going to block the entrance into Bank of America Stadium. But as the day went on, police kind of corralled them into one area. There's a lot of media taking pictures and shooting video. They're holding their signs and hearing the same chants that we've been hearing throughout the week, which is not only no justice, no peace, but even though the Charlotte Police Department did release a couple videos yesterday, there's still other videos that have not come out, and so we're hearing calls for those videos to also be released.
The overnight protests were getting a little bit violent, and the mayor called for a curfew. How is that working out?
So the curfew has been officially at midnight and lifted at 6 a.m. each day, but police haven't been enforcing it. People have been out way longer than 12 o'clock, and our understanding through the police department has been that it's always been at officers' discretion whether or not they want to actually enforce the curfew. And we, as the media, never had to abide by the curfew, but again, the civilians on the street, protesters, demonstrators, it was all at police discretion, and it was not enforced that we saw.
Initially, the protests were centered about videos that the police had from dash cams and also body cams during the incident. Now that they've been released and really don't seem to show a lot of details, what are the protesters seeking now?
You hit the nail on the head. What's happening is that the Charlotte Police Department only put out two videos, and there's more than two videos available. But right now, they're only kind of trickling out the information. So you still kind of have this air of suspicion towards the police. That while the chief says in one breath that he wants to be transparent, on the other hand, he's not being transparent. They're not releasing all the videos. So what we've all seen that in the footage that has come out so far is not any clarity. That we're not seeing necessarily a handgun. We're not seeing necessarily any type of threatening movement. And we're also not seeing the other videos that may or may not justify the killing that happened of Keith Scott this past week.
Arash, you mentioned it's Sunday and time for church and football in the Deep South. We know you're going to be also working on a story about that, and we look forward to seeing that on VOAnews.com.
It's always a pleasure.
VOA's Arash Arabasadi in Charlotte, North Carolina. Here in Studio 22, it's time for G. Abby Lee as she joins me with our social media segment and all the things, the online reaction to our top story. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. So the body and dash cam videos of the fatal police shooting in Charlotte, North Carolina is definitely trending this Sunday. The local police department released a video on Saturday, as you mentioned, following days of pressure from the public, and the law enforcement also released photos of pot and a gun allegedly belonging to the late Keith Lamont Scott.
Well, gee, police brutality has been a huge topic of discussion here in America this year. Mm-hmm. What's the discussion like this time?
Not very much different, but it's also quite difficult to judge the situation from the released portions of the video because, as you could have probably tell, that you don't have audio for all of the footage, and also the public debate is more about why the police department highlighted whether Scott had a gun at the time of the incident, because it's legal to have a gun in America. So many Facebook and Twitter users are asking the question, but others still argue that it's not a good use of our time to discuss just one incident when there was a shooting in Baltimore and also in Chicago recently that left more people dead.
So apparently not too much different from the other police shootings. Mm-hmm. I also want to add that this may be one of the final police dash cam videos that will be released in North Carolina.
That's right. A new law goes into effect on October 1st that will block the public from obtaining these recordings in that state. Now, moving on to a more fun topic, another trending topic is that social media company Snapchat rebranded itself as Snap Inc. in time for the release of its first hardware product, and those are sunglasses that record videos. It's called Spectacles, you know, mm-hmm. Snapchat mm-hmm. and Spectacles, and comes in three different colors and one size.
Wow, does it cost a fortune?
Well, that's part of the debate because it retails for $129.99, so that's around $130 per pair. Would you get yourself one for a Shay that records videos up to 10 seconds?
I'm not sure. I have a phone.
Yeah, that's true. Another debate is on whether they want to support the CEO, Evan Spiegel. Some say he's different from the typical startup billionaires because he's not a Silicon Valley guy who focuses on craft beer and being nerdy. I didn't even know beers are a thing. Others say he is exactly that guy. I don't know about that, but whoever is married to supermodel Miranda Kerr is actually engaged to her is good in my book. Back to you, Jim.
All right. Well, actually, our person for social media updates is G. Abby Lee. You can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE or at @VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories trending in Asia, airstrike kills senior Pakistani militant leader in Afghanistan. South China Sea claimants blur lines between military and civilians. India signs an $8.7 billion deal with France for 36 fighter jets. Chinese animal lovers oppose Shanghai hosting the World Dog Show. Indonesian conservatives blame reckless development for deadly floods. You'll find these stories and much more on our VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The United States and its European allies called an emergency session of the UN Security Council early Sunday to address the crisis in Syria. Britain, France, and the United States are urging Russia to take extraordinary steps to support a cessation of hostilities in Syria. In a joint statement, foreign ministers from the United States, France, Italy, Germany, Britain, and high representatives of the European Union pushed Moscow to support humanitarian assistance, stop bombings on Syrians, and renew truce efforts. The allies maintained their commitment to dismantle the Islamic State group and asked Russia to focus on al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Syria. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon heaped criticism on the international community and urged world powers to do more now.
I'm appalled by the military escalation in the city of Aleppo, which is facing the most sustained and intense bombardment since the start of the Syrian conflict. The The use of bunker-busting bombs brings the violence to new depth of barbarity. Let us remember, the fighting has forced the hospitals and schools to operate in basements. These bombs are not busting bunkers. They are demolishing ordinary people looking for any last refuge of safety. International law is clear. The systematic use of indiscriminate weapons in densely populated area is a war crime.
Separately, a grouping of Syrian humanitarian organizations warned that no truce will hold in the war-shattered country as long as Syrian forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad and their Russian allies are permitted to bomb, starve, and torture Syrian civilians with impunity. The Save Our Syria organization said its delegates will not support a return to Geneva peace talks until a guarantee is provided that Syrian civilians will be protected through the enforcement of a nationwide no-bomb zone. In just over a day from now, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will face each other in the first of three U.S. presidential debates leading up to the November 8th election. Now, we're not certain what we may witness, but VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins me in the studio to share some observations.
Jim, they're expecting huge ratings for this. I mean, this could be the most watched event between now and, I don't know, the Super Bowl.
And I'm sure Trump will claim the ratings as another one of his shows.
You have two people who are no strangers to the debate stage. This is Hillary Clinton's second run for the presidency. And of course, before that, she ran for the Senate and participated in debates. She performed quite well against Bernie Sanders going back to primary season. And then you have Donald Trump, who was never accused of having a very strong command of the facts, but managed to barrel his way through just about every Republican primary debate earlier this year. And you have the two of them, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, going head to head. I don't know to what extent people will be watching this in order to inform their voting decision and to what extent they will be watching for the sheer spectacle of it all. But I suspect that a lot of people will tune in.
I've heard the pundits bantering around potential strategies for both candidates. The consensus seems to be that Trump needs to kind of keep himself reined in, if you will, for longer than 30 minutes, which may be difficult.
You know, if you talk to the Hillary Clinton people, they will tell you that they feel that, in essence, Trump has an advantage in that expectations for him are so low that if he shows up at Hofstra University in New York and simply sounds reasonably coherent, that he will win the debate just because people are expecting such outrageous things out of him. And if he looks with a sort of modicum of a presidential air and comes out with some things that people can relate to, that he will be sort of catapulted in people's estimation of him. Hillary Clinton is someone who, as far as I know, has been preparing for these debates for several weeks. And it's my understanding that she has these enormous notebooks full of facts and figures and things to sort of wow people with. I don't know that debates are really won on the strength of facts that one brings. There's a lot of style that is brought into this. And I suspect that if she goes into the debate a la Gore of 2000, who was someone who was very cerebral and brought a lot of facts and figures to the debate, but didn't fare all that well in the debate against George W. Bush, I suspect that that could be something of a tactical error on her part.
We will definitely be watching this first presidential debate and giving us a front row seat perspective, as always, VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Thank you, Michael.
It's always a pleasure.
And you can follow all the details of the debate and the debate itself right here on The Voice of America, just a day away from that event. It's not often that a new museum opens up here in Washington and also shuts down many of its streets, but President Barack Obama led the nation in dedicating the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. It's a new $540 million museum, and it opened its doors to the public on Saturday. VOA's Chris Simpkins has more on the museum and those who made the journey to be among the first to see it.
Let us now open this museum to the world.
It's America's newest museum, and it's fitting that the country's first black president dedicated it.
But what this museum does show us is that even in the face of oppression, even in the face of unimaginable difficulty, America has moved forward. And so this museum provides context for the debates of our times.
Ringing a bell that hung in a church built by slaves and free blacks, Obama officially opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. It was a celebration for thousands who journeyed to the nation's capital to be among the first to see the museum.
The depiction that they used, from the chronological approach that they used, was exceptional.
The museum takes visitors on a journey through time, from the dark chapters of slavery through racial segregation and discrimination.
And a lot of people don't want to talk about slavery, but I think it's very important because, our ancestors came from Africa. They were brought over here. They were slaves. And I don't think that it's something to be ashamed of. I think that they're very strong that they made it this far.
Many items in the museum are priceless heirlooms from family collections. The collections tell the stories not just of famous people, but also those of ordinary people determined to make their lives better, such as Alex Davis from Michigan, who participated in the civil rights demonstrations.
I think the kids today need to know that there was a history that needed to be changed, and somebody had to do that. So it's like I tell my kids, I march so that you don't have to.
People here say the museum will serve as a lasting showcase of the challenges African Americans have faced and how much they have contributed to the country's history. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
There are so many must-see things here in Washington, and now you can add another one to the list. The National Museum of African American History and Culture. All you have to do is just wander toward the Washington Monument, and you'll find it. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. International Edition's Sarah Williams and VOA Music's Nikki Strong chat about a country music star who's shooting up the charts.
Well, another country artist makes history. Nikki Strong of VOA 1 is here with all the details. So, Nikki, who is it and what have they done?
Okay, well, it's Kelsey Ballerini. And I like to say, in the words of Alicia Keys, this girl is on fire. So her current single, Peter Pan, just hit number one on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart and number one on the Billboard Hot Country Airplay chart at the same time.
Wow.
And she is the first solo female artist to actually do this. And just to put it in some perspective, on the Hot Country Songs chart, Florida Georgia Line has remained number one for 18 weeks straight. So Carrie Underwood hasn't been able to knock them off. Sam Hunt released something, has not been able to knock them off. Luke Bryan, these are all heavy hitters, unable to knock them off. Here comes Kelsea Ballerini. She's a new artist. This is her debut project. When I first heard the song Peter Pan, I thought it was a hit, but I did not expect it, because she was new and a woman, to be able to actually hit number one and to knock Florida Georgia Line an 18-week winning streak. So I think that is absolutely incredible. And the song itself really did not fly up the charts. I mean, it was almost like the, you know, I think I can, I think I can, the little train. Mm-hmm. And she actually accomplished it. So it's awesome.
Well, she's also the first female artist to have her first three singles from her debut solo project hit number one since Winona Judd in 1992. That's going back a bit.
Yeah. So it's a long time coming. I think it's awesome. And this is, again, her third song to hit number one. Long time coming for a woman artist in general. This should be more frequent, I think. She is also the first female artist since Carrie Underwood to have her first single from her debut project hit number one on the country airplay chart. And her brand new single, which has just been released, is called Yeah Boy, which I think is very radio friendly, should also do well.
Well, Kelsea's also working with Taylor Swift, too, now as well.
They are. They are working together on a song, which I think is great. That should really propel her career even further, especially as she prepares to headline her first tour first headlining tour. And who knows, maybe Taylor will, you know, make an appearance. That would be fun.
That certainly would be. Well, you can hear more music from Kelsea Ballerini on Country Hits with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Twitter and Facebook at VOA 1 The Hits. Thanks very much, Nikki.
Thank you. Always gonna fly away just because you know you can.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer Daryl Smith. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Come back when you can. International Edition is on 3 times a day on VOA. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On September 18th, the Foreign Minister of Japan, Fumio Kishida, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, and the Republic of Korea's Foreign Minister Yoon Byung-se held a meeting in New York on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly to discuss their country's coordinated response to North Korea's most recent nuclear test and its other recent and repeated missile-related provocations. In a joint statement after the meeting, the three top diplomats said that North Korea's flagrant disregard for multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions expressly prohibiting its ballistic missile and nuclear programs requires even stronger international pressure on the regime. North Korea's provocative actions are further deepening its isolation and undermining the need of its people, who suffer greatly at the hands of the regime. In this regard, the three countries are working closely with partners at the United Nations and in other fora to pressure the DPRK. In remarks to the press in the company of the two foreign ministers, Secretary of State John Kerry said that the United States remains deeply committed to our treaty obligations, to our mutual defense obligations, and to rolling back the provocative, reckless behavior of the DPRK. Referring to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as a reckless dictator, Mr. Kerry declared that the global community will not be intimidated and will not pull back from our obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and all of our international efforts to rein in nuclear weapons rather than see them proliferate. Secretary Kerry said the United States is prepared to sit down with North Korea to deal with issues of peace on the Korean Peninsula, ending the DPRK's isolation and attracting economic development, as long as North Korea is prepared to honor its international obligations and previous commitments to denuclearization. The immediate need for the North Korean leadership, he said, is for them to not engage in any more provocative actions, not engage in more testing, particularly, in order to bring countries together and to begin a serious negotiation about the future. The joint statement from the meeting also noted the positive role that the United States, Japan, and the Republic of Korea are playing to promote regional peace and stability and address global challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.